Welcome to episode 3 of Behind the Shield. My name is James Gearing, and I will be your host for this podcast. My guest on this episode is American farmer Joel Salatin. Now, Joel, other than a farmer, is also a lecturer and an author. His books include Folks This Ain't Normal, You Can Farm, and The Marvelous Pigness of Pigs. Joel is an English major from Bob Jones University. He is featured in food documentaries Food, Inc. and Fresh, which I recommend both of those. He has done TED Talks and spoken at Google. And Joel is known for his holistic method of animal husbandry. He has a very unique look at not only the way the animals are raised, but even the way the food that they eat is grown. So he will move his animals through geographically through his farm to make sure that the acorns, the grass, whatever they're actually eating normally, has grown to the point where it has the maximum nutrition and the minimum amount of stress. So the product is the healthiest, leanest meat that you can get. And therefore, this low stress, high nutrition environment creates the healthiest meat for the people that he sells to. He doesn't use any chemicals, any drugs, or GMO feed. Now, this whole topic is so important to me. When you look outside the window, you look at our fellow citizens here in the US, in the UK, and other Western developed countries, you are seeing a growing trend of ill health. This can absolutely be improved through exercise and movement, but let's say you exercise for 4 days a week, about an hour at a time. Well, that's only 4 hours total in the 150 odd hours a week that you have available to you. So the rest of the time is obviously in that balance of energy in, energy out. The quality of that food is even more important. The gastrointestinal tract is 80% of your immune system. So what you put in is either going to hurt or nourish your body. The food that we've been eating, even the salads and the vegetables, and people think they're eating well, if they're covered in pesticides, if people are wearing hazmat suits to apply this to the food that then goes into your children's body, clearly every cell in that food is not going to be beneficial. It's going to have some good properties, but obviously some bad properties as well. When you go locally to organic farms and you get vegetables and fruit that have not been sprayed with these chemicals, that have been grown naturally, that's 100% nourishment, 100% nutrition. The same with the meat. If the meat has not been treated with hormones and antibiotics, and the meat hasn't been shoulder to shoulder in some god-awful warehouse with these stress hormones just surging through these poor animals, if its growth hasn't been rapidly accelerated through chemicals, then the meat that you ingest is going to nourish your body. If it's this sick, overdeveloped meat that's kept alive through pharmaceuticals, then again, this meat is not going to nourish. It's going to hurt. We've seen a rapid increase in the amount of disease in this country, heart disease, cancer, and I am 100% sure that a large part of it is to do with the food that we are served. The other benefit of buying locally from these sustainable farms is you remove the transportation costs. You remove the packaging, the impact on the environment. So your local farmer, if you select one that prescribes to the same philosophy, doesn't have to ship that food 3,000 miles, doesn't have to cling wrap it and irradiate it and all the other processes that happen to the food that are in the supermarket. And the misunderstanding that this food is more expensive is another lie. You take away the middleman, the Publix, the supermarket that's obviously trying to make a profit, and understandably so, the cost of processing, the cost of packaging, the cost of transportation, and you go from the home directly to the source, i.e. your local farmer, they can afford to give you this product at a cheaper rate than the grocery stores do, because all those middlemen that are taking a cut have been eliminated. So that is a fallacy that good food is more expensive. It really isn't if you know where to look. The other element is we consume way too much meat in this country. So to think of it more like quality instead of quantity, you take out a third of the real meat consumption, replace it with more vegetables, beans, that kind of thing. When you do buy your meat, you buy the high quality meat, and that way you know you're nourishing your body instead of hurting it. So in this interview, we talk about the food industry and how it became industrialized in the first place. We touch on the effects of this process on our food and why chemicals are usually used in factory farming, how sustainable farming creates the best quality food, how to find a local farmer. Joel's up in the Northeast, so everyone listening to this needs to find a farmer that subscribes to this same philosophy in their local area. So he'll talk about it and we'll provide links to where he suggests on the show notes as well. And then how to start a garden, how to take even that farmer out of the equation and grow some of this stuff yourself. So it doesn't have to be an entire smorgasbord of vegetables and fruit, but there's a few things that are very easy to grow in your local area. You can have chickens in a chicken coop. There's all kinds of ideas that he comes up with. And making yourself more sustainable. And that's going to affect, you know, how much you spend on food. You know, if you're growing it yourself, then you can remove that cost from, you know, buying those certain vegetables or eggs or poultry. I am very excited to introduce Joel. I think he's a voice that we don't normally hear. When we talk about nutrition, you hear the doctor telling you about lower your cholesterol, remove fats from your diet. And you talk about calorie counting and all these areas of nutrition, but no one ever talks about where the food comes from fundamentally and how if you eat this type of food and have an abundance of vegetables on your plate, you can really forget about calorie counting. This will totally nourish your body. And if you remove a lot of the processed foods, you really eliminate the need to quote unquote count calories. So without further ado, I am extremely excited to introduce to you Joel Salatin. So thank you so much for agreeing to be on Behind the Shield. One of the main problems that we have in first responders, firemen, policemen, EMS, is miseducation, I guess you could say, from the dietary point of view. There's a big push on the exercise side of losing weight and that kind of thing, but I think there's a huge lack of knowledge of the kinds of food people should be eating and also fundamentally where that food is coming from in the first place. So I'd love to take you down that road and have you educate everyone that's listening. I wonder if we could start with the actual farm itself. I understand your parents bought the farm, is that correct?
Yes, my mom and dad bought this when I was just four in 1961. So we've been here not quite 60 years. And I grew up here. My mother's still alive and day-to-day operations are now done by our son, Daniel, and we have our grandchildren here, so we have four generations here on the farm.
Fantastic. And when you got there, was the soil in incredible condition?
it was in incredible condition, incredibly bad. We had very large gullies, like corrugated roofing, you know, down the hillsides, large rock, you know, rock areas that had, you know, no vegetation on them whatsoever. These were shale areas, you know, a quarter acre or so in size that literally it was bare rock. And today all those areas are covered up with 12 inches of soil. You know, it's not 3 feet like it was 500 years ago, but at least it's covered up and growing something. And the gullies are healing slowly. And it's, it was arguably the armpit of the community today. I would say arguably the most productive farm in the community.
Yeah, certainly the most well known. That's for sure. I grew up on a farm myself. My father was a veterinary surgeon in England, so I've had a unique perspective of, you know, 2016 and the years prior and how we are fed and the choices that we make. I know that we weren't completely organic. I remember using fertilizer and pesticide on some of the foods and The chickens were fed meal as well as pecking around in the grass. And I know we're going to talk about the way that you farm some of those. But it gave me a different perspective when I came over here and see so many people choosing their food from the fridge. The frozen aisle or everything being in a packet. Now, did you always want to be a farmer? Were you destined to be a farmer since you were young?
Yes, from my earliest memories, I definitely wanted to be a farmer. I think, looking back as you start thinking about your childhood memories sometimes, I realize now the impact that my grandfather's farm and my great uncle's farm had on me. My grandfather, actually, I shouldn't say farm, his garden and my uncle's farm. I said, we came to this place. It was just, rocks and weeds and gullies, and it was in rough shape. But their places, my grandfather was a charter subscriber to Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming magazine in 1949. Had just this lush garden. It was bounded with a tea trellis grape arbor, and I was a kid, and you could reach up and just pick these ripe, succulent grapes, and it just seemed, boundless to me. And I think I never got away from that almost subconscious desire to nest in abundance, to be able to walk out the back door every day, and feel like you're immersed and nestled. In abundance. Very, very powerful metaphor.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, your parents then, when you were growing up, clearly they had a different philosophy than a lot of people in that generation. So how was their philosophy formed to kick so hard against what a lot of the other farms were doing around them?
That's a great question. My dad, his degree was in economics. He was in World War II. And then went to college after the war and got his degree in economics. And I think he came to this more from an economic level than an environmental level. And he realized early on that the chemical approach, whether it's chemical fertilizer, pesticide, herbicide, whatever, but trying to beat nature with chemicals was essentially a drug addiction. It was like a drug addiction, and it was a vicious circle where you couldn't ever get ahead because nature bats last, and so you were constantly looking for more potent chemicals, more chemicals. We used 100 pounds last year, we got to use 200 this year, and he just saw it as a treadmill that you could never get off of. I mean, like economically, you can't debt yourself into wealth, and you can't chemicalize yourself into health either. And he saw that, I think, as primarily an economic equation, much more than an environmental equation, which is kind of interesting. Because most people, as soon as they hear about, not using all that stuff, they assume that you don't have an appreciation for economics, because economics means that you go to concentrated animal feeding operations and factory and industrial monospeciated farms and chemicals and all that stuff. So I like to point that out because I think the assumption is that when you do well by the environment, you hurt yourself economically, and if you're going to do well economically, you necessarily have to make some compromises on the environment.
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of reminds me of I did an economics class years and years ago in England, and one of the only things that stuck, I don't even think I finished the class, to be honest, but was the term false economy. And I think that's where we're at now, is that they thought that these farming methods were gonna save money initially, but obviously in the long run now we have a nation of extremely unwell people, and now we're like you said, the debt is now having to be paid physically. And I remember you had a great quote in one of your interviews I heard you in. A gentleman in the 1940s had said something about if you put chemicals in your food, eventually the people will have to be chemicalized as well.
Yeah, that was Sir Albert Howard, the British agronomist who brought aerobic, the scientist who brought basically the aerobic composting formula of carbon, nitrogen, moisture, oxygen, and microbes to the world in 1943, writing his iconic An Agricultural Testament, which is kind of considered, you know, one of the pillars of the entire sustainable ag, regenerative agriculture movement. He said, when we use artificial manures, that's what he called chemical fertilizers, artificial manures, we grow artificial plants, which feed artificial animals, which make artificial people who can only be kept alive by using artificials. And of course, look at our pharmaceutical industry. That was 1943 when he said that, and certainly, you know, being kept alive with artificials is certainly where our nation has come at this point.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that pretty much anyone that deals with EMS that's listening to this can testify that we have these patients with literally a trash bag full of medications, and they're not fixing anything at all. And the bigger irony is anyone in the medical community has to take the Hippocratic Oath. Yeah, Hippocrates himself said, let food be thy medicine. So that's, to me, the biggest irony you can possibly have in the medical industry right now.
Yes. And I think one of the problems is that nobody knows what their tolerances are. I don't want anybody to listening to this to think that I'm some sort of a cultish and it's anathema to ever eat a Snickers bar or even drink a Coke for that matter. Okay. But there's a big difference between having one once a month as a little treat and having two a day or three a day. And you know, moderation in all things. And so EMS personnel routinely spend a lot of time hanging out at the rescue squad or the fire station or whatever. And what do we do when we just kind of hang around? Well, we snack, you know, we snack on things. And so the old adage, you know, that the cops all go down to Dunkin' Donuts. The reason it's humor is good humor is because there's an element of truth to it. And so, we need to appreciate that none of us knows where our tolerances are. We don't know when that snacking and what we're snacking on is going to result in diabetes or obesity or, you know, any of these kinds of things. And the truth is, if you look at the label, you know, you can't pronounce half of the stuff that's on the label. And that's brand new in the human lexicon and the human gut. The microbiome, was not designed to handle things that you needed to be a scientist in a laboratory to make, or things that were too hard to pronounce, to say. I'm kind of with Michael Pollan, who says, you know, we probably shouldn't eat anything that wasn't available before 1900. That's kind of when things really went south. And of course, we can all be very thankful that hot dogs were introduced at the 1890 World's Fair. So, you know, hot dogs just squeaked in under the 1900s benchmark.
That was the ones without nitrates back then, probably.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. They were. Yeah. Yeah. On our farm, we make we make hot dogs, and they don't have anything unpronounceable. You know, it's just beef and pork, and they're really great. And they actually taste like food. They don't taste like, you know, some synthetic material.
Yeah, absolutely. So that kind of pushed me to the next question. I think this is a huge pivotal one. We, obviously, our generation, I'm 42 now, so I was raised outside of my farm. I was raised to believe that, you know, it's safe to spray all our food in insecticides and, you know, the mass production and pasteurizing our milk and all these other areas that we literally were taught by our school boards and our health boards of the respective countries. So when did the industrialization of food really begin? And then what was the regression from there?
Well, I think that the real catalyst came post-World War II, because you have to remember that ammunition, bombs, explosives, are made from nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. And, of course, those are the three things that are in chemical fertilizer. And so after World War II, we had all these stockpiles of N, P, and K. We had all these businesses, you know, that, you know, big businesses that had developed to mine and bag and create N, P, and K. And so it was extremely cheap. And so the natural thing was, well, let's find a market for these things. Let's go. And of course, in that day, you know, you could sprinkle some of this on the soil and it would really take off. Well, the soils, a lot of the soils responded to it because they still had organic matter left over from draft power from all the animal manures and all that stuff. So, you know, they responded to it. And so I'm a little bit careful to, you know, to cast great disparagements on, you know, on great grandpa who reached for that bag of chemical fertilizer as opposed to shoveling in a day when, you know, there were not front end loaders. You know, there was, so the alternative was, well, do I spread this little bag of stuff? I mean, it's like a miracle. Or do I shovel? And people were tired of shoveling. They'd been shoveling all the time. And so for the first 5 or 6 years, you know, this took off. And, of course, it was all cheap because they were leftover stockpiles from the war effort. In many cases, it had virtually been paid for and was just, you know, a salvage operation. So it was extremely cheap, extremely, you know, marketable. Accessible. And so that took off. Well, in the early 1950s then, you know, we had the development of the tractor and, of course, rural electrification, plastic pipe, chippers, shredders, you know, and gradually the components to run a true carbon-centric system gradually came into being through the 1950s. So that by 1960, there was absolutely no reason whatsoever to be using chemical fertilizers. But by that time, that orthodoxy was so entrenched in the cultural psyche that it was very difficult to, as we say, unring that bell. You can't unring a bell. And so you couldn't restart that clock. By that time, you know, the land-grant universities, the research nonprofits, all of the USDA, all of these things were stacked and stocked with a paradigm that was a chemical-oriented paradigm. The truth is that if we had had a Manhattan Project for compost, not only would we have fed the world, we would have done it without three-legged salamanders, infertile frogs, in a dead zone the size of New Jersey in the Gulf of Mexico. That's the truth, but we didn't have a Manhattan project for that. We had a Manhattan project for something else, and so that's where we ended up.
Right, and then the Monsanto pesticide area was another separate arm of that whole movement.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, it's like every if you read you know, the Diffusion of Innovation, these business books that talk about, you know, new things and how they market, how they change markets and how markets adapt. What you see is this, you know, gentle, slow start. And then the trajectory starts to steepen and steepen, because you get all the components necessary to make it efficient, you know, mining, laboratories, distribution, packaging, marketing, advertising, you know, all these things have to come together. And so it just got, you know, steeper, and the curve got faster and faster. And so, you know, what started out as pigs coming in off of pasture and going into a small piggery of 20 sows gradually became a piggery, you know, a concentrated animal feeding operation of 5,000 sows. pigs, chickens, the same thing. Antibiotics played a huge role in this, because prior to antibiotics, you simply couldn't put this many animals in one spot in such filthy conditions and have them survive. So the concentrated animal feeding operation was definitely a product of antibiotics that allowed us to keep these animals alive in such filthy and unsanitary conditions. And then, of course, you had petroleum came along, which allowed us to efficiently transport stuff. I mean, you couldn't have a CAFO 150 years ago because you simply couldn't bring in that much foodstuffs and haul out that much manure. You simply couldn't do it 150 years ago because you couldn't do it with draft power. Transportation was too expensive and too difficult, too arduous and laborious. But when petroleum came along and transportation was extremely cheap, then all of these historic kind of boundaries could be broken, and you could do pretty much anything you wanted to. So you have a pocket full of antibiotics and the truck is idling in the, you know, on the porch, and suddenly all these historic parameters, these historic norms, could be punched through. You know, we didn't have to do only what we could move with draft power. We didn't have to do only what we could shovel or move. And you know, then as we did that, you know, the capacity to take that paradigm on down the road did indeed occur. And you know, Joel Arthur Barker, who wrote the book Paradigms, said that every paradigm eventually exceeds its point of efficiency. And that's, of course, exactly where we are now, as this paradigm of concentrated animals, segregated food systems, monospeciation, chemical fertilization, and now, of course, genetically modified organisms and whatever. These have now, you know, continued to accelerate. And so now, suddenly, in the last 30 years, we have this burgeoning problem with, for example, food allergies. You know, when I was growing up, the phrase food allergies didn't even exist. I mean, nobody said anything. You could have a potluck or a get together. Nobody had to worry about gluten or peanuts or whatever. And now, you know, you can't have a get together without accommodating half a dozen special food allergy requests. Then you have, you know, E. coli, Salmonella, Campylobacter, Listeria, bovine spongiform encephalopathy. You know, all of these things have come in the last 30 years as that supposedly progressive and scientific paradigm has exceeded its point of efficiency, and nature is now batting last, and we're seeing it, of course, in consequences, as you mentioned, you know, in bags full of medications, and you know, social, emotional problems from rage to depression to all sorts of things that, of course, first responders deal with on a daily basis. For sure, first responders are on the, you know, on the cutting edge of society's fringes, and it's society's fringes where you see the fabric, the matrix of a civilization, you see them beginning to crumble. And so first responders have a very unique and special look into the mortar that's cracking on the bastions of civilization. It's quite profound.
Yeah, that's a very good way of looking at it. I never even thought about that. But I think to me, it's just so blatant that the philosophy we have in our healthcare at the moment just does not work. It's not like someone has blood pressure medicine for 6 months and then they come up to you one day like, God, that medicine works so well. My blood pressure is perfect now. I don't have to take it anymore. That never happens. They're on that medication the rest of their life. They're on the diabetes medication, the cholesterol medication, and you you see, I see my blood work from the way I eat, and you see some of these great documentaries, Food Inc. and Forks Over Knives and Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead, and you see these people healed just by returning and eating the way they were supposed to eat 100 years ago. And it's that simple, and yet this lie is so ingrained in people's psyche that when you talk to them like that, you get looked at like you're, you know, you just pooped in their cornflakes. And it's incredible that, I mean, that, you know, they've managed to pull that off in such a short time.
Well, it certainly is. And then you have the fire station and rescue squad. And again, everybody's hanging around there. So they've got vending machines with nabs and soda and all this in. I mean, it's just a disaster waiting to happen. And so, yes, the whole food, the body food connection is profoundly inarguable today. And everywhere I go, I run into people that have, you know, healed their children from autism, healed themselves from cancers, all sorts of things, simply by fundamentally changing diet. You know, the human experience, was not designed to be, to be propped up, to have crutches of pharmaceuticals. You know, that should be the person that needs this stuff should be an anomaly, not the norm. And the fact that it is becoming such a norm is indicative that something is, you know, greatly out of whack.
Absolutely. I know one of the statistics that blew me away was, and I didn't realize this till somewhat recently, that the GI tract is actually 80% of our immune system. So obviously whatever you put in your mouth that travels through that tube and comes out the other end is going to affect you positively or negatively. And as you mentioned with the bacteria in there, it's going to kill them and destroy everything, or it's going to get them to bloom and thrive in the right way, not in an imbalanced way like C. diff or something like that.
Yes. Well, you know, we are studying now a lot of the whole microbiome thing, and each of us has 3 trillion beings, critters, in our digestive tract. 3 trillion. I mean, that's a pretty big community. And when you think about it, there's a lot of intricacy there too. And, you know, they have to build highways and have fire stations and rescue squads and hospitals and schools and, you know, go to the, you know, Lions Club and whatever. I mean, they're doing all sorts of stuff down there. And that's a very complex community to maintain. And if we put toxins into it, if we put foreign material into that community, it's going to upset that community, just like, you know, polluted water in a community or corrupt politicians or whatever. You throw corruption in a community, and you're gonna be in disarray. And that's the same thing in this bacterial microbial community of 3 trillion members in our gut. We don't see it, but it's nonetheless there and completely dependent on what we're giving it every day.
Right. And is that, am I correct in understanding that down the line of GMOs, by messing with the genetic structure of these you know, basically foreign objects, that the body is now not able to recognize them, these ancient bacteria are not able to recognize these particles that are coming in, and that's what's causing the problems? Or am I off there?
No, you're in the ballpark, and you know, I'm not a scientist in that regard, so I can't give you all the Latin ins and outs of this thing. But yes, you're exactly right. The GMO studies that have been done, where they actually feed them the way you and I would eat, and not in some special contrived prejudicial study that Monsanto sets up. The the true. I mean, I'll give you an example. When Monsanto was looking at GMO potatoes, for example, they specifically chose geriatric rats. This is all in Jeffrey Smith's book, Seeds of Deception. It's a great book. Anybody that wants to, you know, get a kind of layman's look at GMOs. And so they got geriatric rats and fed them. Well, they didn't see any difference in the GMOs versus the non-GMOs. But when the same experiment was repeated in Scotland, but instead of being completely repeated, they repeated everything except they used juvenile rats instead of geriatric rats. Well, then suddenly they had all sorts of problems. They had organ malfunction. They had sociopathy. Had mental breakdown. All sorts of problems just by changing the experiment from geriatric rats who already, you know, had their routines and their personalities and their organs and whatever. You know, there's no, you know, geriatrics, they don't change much. They've already lived their life and it's done. You don't see the big differences, but in the young ones where the metabolism is faster and they're still developing, they saw, you know, huge, huge differences. And so, you know, these kinds of studies have been now done all over the world. And the only people who can't see them, of course, are the people who are, who are in agreement with the basic idea that life is fundamentally mechanical. And, you know, that's where it comes down. The industrial mindset suggests that life is fundamentally mechanical, and we can tweak and move and adjust this DNA and that DNA and throw chemicals on the soil and whatever. Whereas many of us believe that life is fundamentally not mechanical but biological. And there's a huge difference between biology and mechanics. One of the big differences is that living things are spontaneous. They kind of think. They don't just follow a routine. They often, you know, kind of have a mind of their own. But the main thing is that biological things can heal. Mechanical things can't. If a bearing goes out in your front wheel of your truck, it's not going to get better by rest or by, you know, praying over it or whatever. It's only going to get better if you take it out and replace it. But, you know, biological things can heal. They can be in rough shape, and you can change the diet. You can change the support. You can have a relationship that's gone south, and you can ask for a forgiveness and apologize, and the relationship can be healed. I mean, this fundamental idea that biological systems can heal is the great hope that we have. And it's a wonderful thing compared to mechanics. But the entire industrial food system that you can live on Twinkies and Cocoa Puffs and Mountain Dew is predicated on the idea that your body and my body and life is fundamentally mechanical, and it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter what biology goes in.
Yeah, it's very. It's very scary. I think one of the other fundamental things that we're seeing, you know, in the last few generations now, is it seems like if you remove the desire to have all the money, all the power, and just disseminate it back to the whole country, we would eliminate a lot of those problems as well. And you see that with the mega farms now, you know, one or two farm companies that want to provide all the food to the entire country or the world for that matter. I mean, of course it's going to just fundamentally fall apart instead of having all these small farms being supported by their local communities and the food traveling, you know, as I know your policy is less than 4 hours. And that way it's not being packaged, it's not being frozen or irradiated or any of those things. You go to your local farmer, you pick up your food and then you bring it home.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of aspects to the global food matrix, as you mentioned, the first one being opaqueness. I mean, you can't follow that chain of custody, and so you don't know what is going on in that, you know, shrimp farm in Thailand that's showing up at your Applebee's restaurant. And so when you start eating more local, you actually have a shorter chain of custody from farm to plate. And the shorter chain of custody allows you to have more accountability because there's more transparency in that shorter chain of custody. And I think another thing that's really powerful is that when you have a local-centric food system, you actually increase a capacity for resilience and security in the food system. You know, when you're dependent on a Costco warehouse 1,000 miles away, that ultimately is a fairly fragile system. I mean, you have to assume that trucks can run on time, that computers work, that the merchant marine gets their, you know, their stuff hauled to the dock on time. You know, a lot of things have to work smoothly in that situation. But when you have a local-centric system where you know your farmer or you know you're very, very close, you can actually see what's on inventory. You know where it is. You can walk there if you had to. The point is that there's a tremendous amount of resiliency and forgiveness built into the system when you have proximity between producer and consumer as opposed to long distance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think another huge lie, really, or misunderstanding, I guess would be a more gentle way of saying it, is that the pesticide-covered foreign fruit and vegetables, for example, that we find in our shelves in the local supermarket are cheaper than organic. And obviously they are if you buy the organic in the same shop or in Whole Foods. But if you just go to your local farmer's market, it's cheaper. I mean, I have bags and bags full of produce that I buy once a week from my local farm. And I mean, literally probably four or five of those cloth grocery bags is for about $50. There's no way in hell you'd be able to buy that much food but again, it's that simple message doesn't get out there. And if you remove the middlemen and the price of the gas and the taxes and all the other skimming that goes on between them and you, then all of a sudden it's cheaper and they still make their money and you still get your food.
Yes. Well, that's exactly right. And you know, you're mentioning this makes me think about the cost of processing and packaging and all that. You know, the way to get affordable food is to get whole food, you know, just raw foods, and then use your own kitchen to prepare, package, preserve, the food. I was in New York City a couple of years ago, and we went down to the Green Market there on Union Square, arguably the most expensive farmers market in the most expensive city of the world. And I asked my hostess, could you show me the most expensive potato in this market? She said, oh, I know just the guy. So we, you know, shoulder our way through the crowd, come up to this farmer with his stand, and he's got a credenza, you know, a bunch of little cubbies with all these potatoes in them. He has about 20 different varieties. Orange ones, red ones, blue ones, long ones, skinny ones, round ones, whatever. And so I looked and I found the most expensive one. It was a blue Peruvian heirloom fingerling potato for $1.99 a pound, which is, you know, a little bit pricey for potatoes. But all around that Green Market are supermarkets with 120 feet of fluorescent lighted tile floor with shelves full of potato chips for $2.99 a pound, you know, way, way more expensive than those little potatoes. So when I say, you know, get in your kitchen, I don't mean go back to, you know, washboards, hoop skirts, and hearth cooking, as romantic as that may sound to somebody that's never done it. You know, we've never techno-gadgetized our kitchens as comfortably as we have today with hot and cold running water, refrigerators, freezers, you know, flick of a button stoves, slow cookers, timed bake, Cuisinarts, fry babies, bread makers, ice cream makers, Tupperware. Grandma would have given her eye teeth for all this stuff. And so it's never, it's we've never been able to more efficiently or sanitarily or simply, you know, actually prepare food. And yet, you know, the average American is far more interested and knowledgeable about the latest dysfunction in the Kardashian household than they are what's going to become flesh of their flesh and bone of their bones at 6 o'clock. And when that's the case, those shortcuts that we take for our own food and nutrition, our own body's well-being, those shortcuts are going to come back to haunt us. And of course, that's exactly what we see.
Yeah, and again, you touched with the packaging. I mean, if you look at our grocery cart full of food, by the time you empty all of those food items out of whatever's surrounding them, you end up with 2 garbage bags full of crap that you got to get rid of now somewhere. Whereas if you're taking home cloth bags full of vegetables, you have zero packaging.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah, well, I mean, just for your own, for canning. I mean, if you bought a bushel basket full of green beans and just canned them, we get an argument about canning or not, but let's just assume that. I mean, put them in glass jars. You know, there's virtually no waste except, you know, you're probably going to throw away the little lid, but the comparison in the amount of packaging material for landfills and for petroleum use and just the sheer volume of that is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it would make such a huge difference on I think everyone's community. I mean, because some people might not have that giant bird-filled mountain in their local area yet, but if you go to any larger urban area, I mean, they have those things at the side of the freeways, and they're just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So something has to stop there too.
Yeah, that's right.
So I'm going to transition now a little bit to Polyface. Well, first I had a question about Polyface. Where did you come up with the name?
Well, poly, of course, is the Greek, the Latin prefix for many. And so we knew that we wanted to do a lot of different things. So we decided that we would be Polyface, the farm of many faces.
Right. And I know you have several different species of livestock on there. The transient pastures that you use in pretty much all your animals, can you describe that? Because I think that's fascinating to me. I watched your TEDx talk, and you, I'm sure you'll talk about it now, but the difference in the maturity of the grasses and how that ultimately affects the animals themselves.
Okay, so grass grows in an S curve, a sigmoid curve. It starts slow, then grows real fast, and then goes into senescence and slows down. And so the reason that there are so many herbivores around the planet is to prune that grass as it moves towards senescence, to prune it back to pre-adolescent stage so it can go through another, you know, vibrant, vigorous, you know, green growth stage, which of course also means that it's going to inhale carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, break off the carbon, leave it in the soil, and exhale the oxygen so you and I can breathe. So when we look at, you know, at nature, at the template of nature, what we see are animals moving. In fact, we see large herds of animals moving, but we don't have those large herds anymore. We don't have the wolves. We don't have fire. So, you know, and an 8 million head herd of bison running down through your Starbucks and the elementary school might not be a really good thing. What we do have now is electric fencing, which acts as a steering mechanism, a steering wheel, a brake, and an accelerator on that four-legged pruner. So we can now steer the animals around the pasture so that we perfectly manage the meeting, the timing of that meeting between plant and animal so that they work in symbiosis rather than competitively. So the cows move every day at 4 o'clock to a new paddock that's been allowed to rest for, you know, 2 or 3 months. So the grass is long, and we mob them in there real, you know, at high density. So they look like a mob of wild herbivores. And then, tomorrow at 4 o'clock, they'll move on to the next paddock. And so any one area will only have a cow on it, you know, maybe 3 or 4 times in a year. Then after the herd moves along, following about 4 days behind, are the egg mobiles. These are portable hen houses, chicken houses with layers, who free range out from those hen houses, scratch through the cow patties, eat out the fly larvae, sanitize the paddock, turn the newly exposed grasshoppers and crickets into eggs, and work symbiotically with the herbivores, just like, you know, the birds in nature. So, you know, these are systems that we use. You know, pigs are out in pig pastures with kind of silvopastures, widely spaced trees, and grasses. And again, they get moved not every day, but every 5 to 12 days, they get moved to a new paddock. And those we touch 3 times a year. Acorn glens in the forest for the pigs, those get touched once or twice a year. They're more extensive and not quite as intensive. Everything is out and moving along.
So it's moving, free range as it's designed to, versus the factory meats that are stressed and side by side and having to be medicated just to basically a chemical life support till they're slaughtered.
Yes, well, yeah, we don't have to use the antibiotics and the grubicides, the parasiticides, and all those things that the industry uses, because we're actually using the different animals in symbiosis, in relational symbiosis to each other. And, you know, there's nothing as exciting as a confused pathogen. And in our industrial system, everything is about monospeciation, you know, whether it's cherry trees or wheat fields or, you know, a Tyson chicken farm. The whole idea is to just grow one thing and grow it very densely and grow it over and over and over again. Well, all three of those things, one thing densely and over, nature doesn't do any of that stuff. Nature is always about multiple things and seasonal differences, different kinds of vegetation, different times of the season, and actually disturbance events, you know, whether it's fire or a big herd moving through, big flock of birds, you know, destroying an area for a day. But nature is all about, you know, change up. And of course, industry is all about same. Keep it the same. Nature is all about spontaneity and dynamics. And so on our farm, we build ponds. We have a lot of tree peninsulas, forestal zones to stimulate wildlife. And of course, the pasture. So you have a lot of this edge effect, you know, open land, forest land, riparian. The ponds we can use for irrigation in a drought. Water is gravity fed through a matrix of 6 miles of water line, water pipes. So we have, you know, fresh gravity pressure, high pressure gravity fed water on the whole place. So, you know, it's not like we sit around here and do nothing. We just try to strategically interact with the landscape in a way that builds resilience and redemptive capacity into the landscape.
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, I've seen the incredible farm that you have now, and to say that you went originally from a very barren landscape, that model surely would be of great interest to areas that do have more drought, whether it's domestic or international, for, you know, potentially growing crops and feeding people there too.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, that would be incredible. So the other question I'm sure that everyone's listening to now is, I'm pretty sure they're sold as I was when I first heard you talk a long time ago. you know, side by side, there's absolutely no question. You know, one animal is inhumanely raised, and obviously the meat is going to be very, very unhealthy, and we're seeing that with the ill health of our nation. And then you've got the humanely raised, that you're part of that group. So what are good resources for people to find a farm like yours in their local area?
Well, fortunately, there are farms that are doing a good job virtually in every community. You know, there's the Weston A. Price Foundation. They do the Smart Shopper's Guide. There are, every state has, you know, some sort of sustainable ag, ecological agriculture, you know, network support group in it. Find out, you know, who that is and check with that outfit. You know, check with your CrossFit gym or wellness centers, naturopaths, acupuncturists. Often, you know, anybody in that alternative wellness community will be plugged into, you know, the wellness food. The point is that this is a non-front page undercurrent. You know, we are an alternative, a guerrilla tribe, if you will, and so we're everywhere. But you have to find us. You have to seek us out, and as soon as you start seeking farmers like ours out, you know, you will find us. I mean, there's for pastured livestock, there's eatwild.com, which is the number one national website for pasture-based livestock. It's not a certification thing. It's just a place where farmers who do this can register. So, you know, there's no substitute for knowing your farmer, know your food, go visit the farm. If the farmer won't let you visit, then, you know, don't go there. We have a 24/7, 365 open door policy here. Anyone can come from anywhere, anytime to see anything unannounced. That's our commitment to transparency. And so you just have to appreciate, you just have to understand that this is a tribe. So if you're seeking that alternative wellness, you know, seek out the alternative wellness community in your community, and you'll find a vibrant support network for these folks. The Nutritional Therapy Association, nutritional therapists, they're a national network. There are several groups that do nutritional therapy. They're plugged in to this wellness community. It's there. You just have to find it.
Fantastic. Now, you mentioned the word certification. It just kind of jarred something else that I've been meaning to ask you. So you are known for preparing your chickens, and is the one I've seen, outside in the fresh air, in the pasture. I know that's frowned upon by the governing agencies that be. So how's that battle coming on? Are the people starting to push now for deregulation of some of that stuff?
Not really. It's generally speaking, it's getting worse and worse. What we are seeing, I think, is a little more ability for small producers to you know, to comply with licensing. There does seem to be some you know, some give in the regulatory world to allow smaller outfits to comply cheaper, easier. And, you know, and this is as it should be. Scale does make a difference. It does make a difference whether you're, you know, making 10 pounds of cheese or 10,000 pounds of cheese. And so this whole compliance thing is a big deal. There are definitely efforts underway to circumvent the compliance, which we think is great. You know, we are big believers in the right of private contract. It's guaranteed by the Bill of Rights, but we haven't been following the Bill of Rights for a very, very long time. And the right of private contract says, essentially, if you and I want to do business together, it's none of the government's business. If we want to do a private contract between each other, I want to buy from you or you want to sell to me or whatever. But we have this big brother bureaucracy that points its nose and gets in the way of of innovative embryonic solutions to our food system, and that then arbitrarily makes the price of alternative food more expensive than it should be. And so these are all, you know, these are all big issues that are all part of the equation and part of our context. And the way to make progress fastest on this front is for more and more and more people to take it upon themselves to find integrity food, patronize it, and realize that we are changing our landscape one bite at a time. Whatever we have on the landscape, the health of our nation, the health of our farms, the health of our soil, all of that today is a physical manifestation of the compounded decisions that everybody's been making for the last X number of years. Where we will be in the future, in 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, will also be a physical manifestation of the decisions we make between now and then. So at the end of the day, my question is, as a result of my decisions this week, have I helped, the old parable of the dog, which dog will survive, which dog will thrive, will the one you feed? So I'm asking, which dog are you feeding? Are you feeding the Monsanto dog, the dog of obesity, health, and ill health, erosion, abuse, and violence? Toward the ecology, toward the biological world, or are you feeding the dog toward wellness, resilience, forgiveness, and healing? And 20 years down the road, we'll know which dog we fed.
Yes, yes, we will. It's interesting. I just found a quote the other day. Winston Churchill actually said, "Healthy citizens are the greatest asset any country can have." Now, following this most recent election process that we've had, I think it's clearer now than ever. And I'm not saying versus left or right. I'm just saying the entire process from beginning to end, that we do need a vote with our dollar. We do need a vote with our individual voice.
Yes.
Because if we put all our faith into whoever they place at the top of the pyramid, which should really be upside down anyway, then we're at their mercy. But if we actually start making decisions and voting, like you said, with our feet, then we are going to change this world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Now, the other thing I wanted to just touch on is, obviously, a lot of people listening to this are going to be in some sort of urban or suburban area. Now, I looked into my homeowners association rules, and I'm not allowed to have chickens or anything. I'm hoping that that's going to change. But do you have any tips on someone that just wants to take a corner of their garden and start a very, very small scale vegetable patch and or chicken coop type deal?
Again, I think the more people do this, you know, the old victory gardens of World War II, the more people that do this, the more awareness there is, the more interest there is. It just moves the conversation forward, and I would say the freedom forward, as more and more people come on board. So, yes, I'm a huge believer in doing something for yourself, and if for no other reason than to just dabble your toe into the awesomeness and the mystery and the magic of life, and I think for children, gardens are amazingly therapeutic, self-affirming. I mean, the self-affirmation that comes from being able to, you know, plant a tomato seed and then, you know, pull a tomato off and watch the juice run down your elbows as you eat that tomato, that is such a more powerful and profound human affirmation than being the top points getter on Angry Birds.
So I think so too.
Yeah, so I think they have a lot to offer. And wonderfully, we now have a lot of infrastructure that enables us to do this more efficiently and easier. We have these PVC pipes with, you know, side pockets in them where you pack them full of compost, you pack your plant in there, you drip on top, and the plants grow out the sides of them, barrels like this. We have the patio gardens, the stackable pots where you can, you know, stack them up on a patio, you know, beehives on your roof, the house roof, solariums, all these wonderful solarium kits. Stick them on the south side of your house, and you can grow. We eat mescaline mix and lettuce, you know, year round from our solarium on the side of our house. Our house was built in 1790. So if we can do it on our house, you can certainly do it on yours. And I think that, that those kinds of visceral participatory actions, move our collective psyche and move our collective understanding of this anchoring to our ecological umbilical. I think it moves it to a place of humility rather than hubris. And I think a place of humility is a place for all of us to start.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think an appreciation, when you open the door, the appreciation of where you are is huge. I live in Central Florida, and people get bogged down in their everyday lives. And I'd say to my little boy, just zoom out for a second. We live in the state where most people will save up to come visit for a week. And this is your home. This is where you live.
Yeah.
So, you know.
That's right.
To appreciate what's around you. And I'm right next to what's called an Ocala National Forest and the Florida Greenway. So we have amazing nature running around. In fact, if my homeowners does stay inflexible, I probably will transition, because this is a horse farm community originally. So there is a lot of land, and there are, you know, some mini farms that you can get for somewhat decent amount. But I think you're...
Yeah, well, those HOA things are just... Oh man, don't even get me started on those things. They're just frustrating. And I'll tell you what they show is not only a profound arrogance toward our dependency on nature, but I think they indicate a condescending attitude toward farming, actually. And you know, why is it that growing a rose bush is perfectly acceptable, but a tomato plant is unacceptable? The only difference is, you know, one's edible and one's just ornamental, but one smacks of garden shows, the other smacks of farmers. And I think that as a culture, we have denigrated farming to the point where most farmers are kind of apologetic about being farmers. Well, you know, I guess I didn't have enough brains to be an engineer or a doctor, so you know, I just became a farmer. And we've got this kind of universal mindset that dumb people farm and smart people don't. And I think that that's a very, very dangerous place to be when the most precious assets of any culture are air, soil, and water, and farmers are our first responders to air, soil, and water, and we've condescended to them as if they don't really matter. And that is a very dangerous place for a civilization to be.
Yeah, well, especially as you said, I mean, they're not doctors, but they are. We've come full circle, and yeah, they provide the very medicine that we need. And I think that there's a phrase that I love is in America and England and other Western countries, we're malnourished and overfed, which sounds like a ridiculous statement, but it's true. The calories that we consume are ungodly, yet the nutrition on the plate is almost non-existent.
That's right. That's right. It's empty. It's empty calories with no nutrition to go with them. That's correct.
Yeah. Well, I would love. I mean, I honestly think there is a movement. There's a couple of phrases I keep hearing now. It's definitely a paradigm shift going on. I think people are finally getting sick and tired of being sick and tired, being worked into the ground, of not sleeping properly, over-medicated. And then the word that comes up a lot is that when you use it yourself is that tribe. And I'm going to have Sebastian Junger on the podcast in next month. And his book, his Tribe, is phenomenal. And as a fireman, and I've touched on this in a couple of my other interviews, that's what's missing in society. And I think he absolutely hit the nail on the head. And I think when you're connected to your community again, and obviously through your farms, you're recreating that tribe that people, you know, that's the fundamental soul of the human species.
Yes. That'll be an exciting program. That'll be great. Good for you.
Yeah, I can't wait for that. Well, this is an exciting program too, though. I mean, I was scrambling because it came together so quickly. But yeah, listening to you, we don't. I mean, like you said it yourself. There's umpteen scientists that you could interview, but how many farmers do you get to, you know, actual conscious farmers that truly grow the way it's supposed to be grown and raise livestock the way it's supposed to be raised and educate our generation? I mean, you know, pretty much yours and mine, everyone younger than us, of what it's supposed to be like, because we were all told something different. And I even growing up on my farm, it was a hybrid of the old style and the industrial style. And my father was a vet, so he was, you know, healing animals the whole time. But even he believed a lot of the things that we were told. So I think the shift really is going to happen. But I think people need to take a look in the mirror and be brave, make a courageous decision and say, I'm going to, you know, it's okay to change your mind. It's okay to say, you know what, you got me. Congratulations, you duped me. And, you know, I have these ailments now, but today is a day I turn around and say enough is enough. And I'm investing in my health. And that example you use, I've heard you in other interviews, people say they can't afford to eat healthy. And then you point out all the material items that we have in our homes that we quote unquote can't live without. It's time to rethink about that.
Right. That's right. There's plenty of money in the system. What's not there is the conviction to live by value, and that's the next, you know, that's the next hurdle. Live by value and just do it. So yeah, that's good.
Absolutely. Okay, well, I'm going to wrap up with a couple of short questions and then I will let you go, because I know you had an interview before this and I'm sure you probably got a bunch of people racked up. So obviously you've written several books yourself. Folks, This Ain't Normal is the one that I've got coming to me. As far as you as a reader, is there a book and or a movie that you recommend?
Food Inc. is as powerful as they get. It's a little bit of a downer. As long as you come out of there realizing there are farmers like me to go patronize, it's good, but it's a little bit of a downer. We like Fresh better. There's a documentary out named Fresh. We're in that one too, but it's a much more upbeat, can-do type of movie. Books. Well, you know, I tend to gravitate toward farming books. But, you know, it doesn't get any better than Wendell Berry, The Unsettling of America. You know, Wendell Berry is iconic in the sustainable ag movement and certainly articulates a lot of the issues very well. He's wonderful to read and profound. So, you know, if somebody wants to just, I mean, besides my books, to look at these issues, Wendell Berry's The Unsettling of America is probably as good as they get.
Okay, yeah, I have seen Fresh as well. That was a very well-made film too. And then one more question. When you need to laugh, when you've had a bad day or you just had enough and you need to laugh, what do you do? Where do you go? Who do you hang out with?
I enjoy being at home. I mean, I travel a lot, so when I want to get away, I get home. So I enjoy being at home. What I do for enjoyment is, you know, I read, and you know, my wife and I are right now going through Downton Abbey. That's just a wonderful series. We don't have a TV. So, you know, we get a DVD of a series if we like it. We have a lot of laughs here on the farm. We've got a lot of people here. Whenever there's a lot of people and they enjoy each other, there's a lot of laughter just in the shenanigans of everyday's ordinary activities. Last evening, I'll tell you this, yesterday afternoon, those of people who know me and have read after me know that I do not have great carpenter skills, but you know, I get along, but just, you know, it's kind of slap dab together, you know. And so yesterday afternoon, I was helping my 13-year-old grandson put together his duck pen in for the winter in one of the hoop houses. And I've done, you know, we've done this every year for like 3 or 4 years. He's had his ducks, and we just make a 12 foot by, you know, by 18 foot. He's only got 40 ducks, so not like that had to be real big. So we kind of make this little plastic bird netting pen inside the hoop house, so the hens, the chickens, are outside, and this little pen of ducks is inside. So it's an enclosure within the enclosure. And we've used the same material stuff every year. Okay, so we're out there, and for some reason last year the boards got misplaced. Somebody put them away. We didn't have them, so we had to start afresh. I thought, oh, let's go make this thing a little bit simpler. So we did, and so we got done. And Travis, he's 13. He just turned 13. He's standing there. He's looking at this. He says, "Well, Grandpa, that's a pretty good job. It just looks like a 2-year-old built." I about laughed till I split. So that's humor.
Yeah, the kids say some funny stuff. I remember not quite the same genre, but I remember when my son was probably only 5, and he came out of the shower holding his manhood and looks at me and goes, "Daddy, look, it's almost as big as yours now." I said, "Thanks. Thanks a lot, Ty." But yeah, that mine keeps me laughing every day too, and I think that's another thing that we're missing. We should be laughing a lot more.
Oh, very good. All right.
So to finish up then, where can people find you just before we hang up, so they know where to look?
Yeah, Polyface Farms is our website. That's all one word, Polyface Farms. If you get Poly about Polyf in there, it'll pop right up. And it's a website. We have all sorts of links. We have resources, lots of information there, places where I'll be speaking, all those kinds of things. We have a gift shop. You know, if you want to wear a shirt that says, grass fed or lunatic farmer or whatever, we have that as well. So, check that out. Lots of information there. And that's Polyface. Farms.com.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thank you so much for talking to us today. I'm sure that there's a huge amount of people out there that are going to have their minds blown by this talk. And I would love if it's okay with you in the future, down the line sometime, to come up to the farm and actually maybe shoot an interview on video, follow up.
Absolutely. We'd love to have you.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thank you so much, Joel. You have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.